Hello, my oral surgery friends. This is your host, Dr. Grant Stuckey. In this podcast, you will hear surgeons discussing ways to improve the practice of oral and maxillofacial surgery. The goal of this podcast is to evaluate every aspect that a surgeon can improve in order to create a better experience for patients, staff, and the surgeon. Most of the information shared in this podcast will be based on personal experience and opinions. The methods discussed are meant to provoke thought and should be supplemented with research into the approved studies prior to making changes to one's way of practice. Without further ado, please enjoy this episode of Everyday Oral Surgery. Welcome to another episode of Everyday Oral Surgery. This is Dr. Grant Stuckey. Today I'm with my friend Dr. Aaron Liddell. He's been on the podcast before. Aaron, thanks for joining us again.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for humoring me.
This is great. Today we wanted to talk a little bit about mandibular fractures, your experience with them, you know, diagnosing, treating them. Of course, this isn't going to be exhaustive. We're not going to talk about everything, but we haven't really talked about this on the podcast, so I thought it'd be good to discuss it.
Yeah. Well, we were just talking before we went live and was on call last week. And I think in total, we did, I opened 5 or 6 condyles and did 5 or 6 parasymphysis fractures and a handful of angle fractures, 1 continuity defect, and doing a fibula on Wednesday for a blasted anterior mandible. So right now it's near and dear to my heart, that dirty curvilinear bone we deal with.
Oh my goodness. And you were saying that it's just the volume's getting more and more each year.
Yeah, I think for any major city, Denver is an interesting demographic. I think with the legalization of marijuana, it brought with it some people that are prone to getting into trouble. And so our volume since that was legalized went up. That's anecdotal. I haven't certainly done studies, and not to suggest marijuana makes you violent, but it just seems like since 16, 17, the numbers have just gotten worse and worse and worse being on call. And, as the city's a popular city too. We have a lot of people moving here. And so I think our volume's just going up. But we talked about our, player group, and it's basically the same as every other city, about 70% interpersonal violence and 30% accidents, whether they're, dog bites or motor vehicle collisions or, baseball players, Valsalva syncopal episodes. It's funny, each one of our hospitals has like a very specific player pool. So like we have 1 Sky Ridge Medical Center, which is sort of in a more upscale area, and that's like all old people Valsalving while having a bowel movement and tanking out and breaking stuff. And then we have the Medical Center of Aurora, which is another player group where that's just a lot of, we call it the knife and gun club. Swedish is a nice little draw of, since it's a level 1 facility, we get a lot of hospital transfers from Kansas and some from surrounding states that just have injuries that are beyond their scope of repair. So it's funny. So when you get a phone call, you kind of know what's coming down the pipeline based on which facility's calling in,
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know about you, but I always got a kick out of, at least in residency, going to ask the patient how they got this fracture, what happened, and I just loved hearing the stories. It's very rare people admit to mouthing off and causing trouble and getting what they deserve.
Right. Right. Yeah. Usually it's a lot of falls. I fell down and hit my face on a doorknob, or I fell into my friend's fist. I had a guy last week that was like, I was looking at his, he had a fairly low condylar neck fracture, and I was kind of scrolling through, and he also had like what looked to be a kind of an older-ish body fracture. It wasn't like chronic, but it was sort of like, looked like it was probably 2 or 3 weeks old. And I was like, were you having jaw pain before you came in this week? And he was like, yeah, to my roommate. We get fights all the time. He punched me in the mouth a few weeks ago, and my bite's been a little funny since then, but didn't really want to come in until my ear canal was, bleeding. So he'd been rolling around with a mid-body fracture for like 2 weeks, and then his friend finished the deal with a left hook and snapped his condyle, so he came in. It's funny. Interestingly, during COVID, we had an uptick in interpersonal violence, like spousal kind of stuff. I think people are around each other too much. Lots and lots of orbital floor blowout fractures from domestic violence, which was kind of crazy. We hadn't seen that kind of volume for a while.
So you're mostly probably talking about fractures caused by different types of trauma from other people. I wanted to touch on as well, those fractures that can happen in the office, iatrogenic, which are probably going to be more of your older population with a wisdom tooth that's been there for 60 plus years and that type of stuff. Do you see many of that? You know, what do you recommend for guys to avoid stuff like that?
Yeah, you know, knock on wood, I've had one sort of, I guess I would call it iatrogenic angle fracture myself, but it was one that I sort of predicted was going to come down the pipeline. And like you alluded to, it was probably a 45-year-old guy with a pretty sizable dentigerous cyst around a deeply impacted third molar. And we sort of shelled it out, no issues at the time, but we'd put him on a liquid diet for a few weeks. And sure enough, he came in with a crack. So, but in terms of third molar removal, you know, it's certainly, I've fixed a number of cases over the years from other practitioners that have snapped mandibles and then maybe inappropriately managed them. I think just sort of recognizing them early on and dealing with them is probably the way to go. You know, obviously the best way to avoid fracturing a jaw, taking out a third molar, is not to use excessive force. I think there's certainly ways that you can finesse teeth out. And a lot of times that doesn't entail, you know, brute force. So just being cautious. So when you're elevating those, especially deeply impacted, and then if you were to have one, for me, we have a plate and screw set in the office that's got a mandible small plate module. And I guess if you were to fracture a jaw, I would just, if it's an angle, it's going to be an angle, right? If you break it at that region, I would just utilize a Champy style superior border tension band and call it a day. You're right there. The access is there. You know, really in the OR, those should take about 10 minutes to do, and it's a quick bend and off you go. And then, you know, liquid diet for a couple of weeks. The other option is every office, as far as I'm concerned, should probably have arch bars and wires available. I mean, just sort of the stuff that we deal with on a day-to-day basis. You could also throw in some arch bars and IMF. But I think, you know, the Champy or superior border tension band technique is fast and it's efficient, and it really works super, super duper well. So I would probably just, you know, if you have the thought that there's a fracture, obviously image stuff, I think people are, it's always hard to take an x-ray when you're worried you might've broken something, but you need to just image the thing. And if you're real nervous about it, seeing the patient back kind of routinely over the first couple of weeks, and then just deal with it. And that usually for me in my practice, I really don't wire anybody shut. So for me, that's going to be putting a plate on real quick there in the office. Shouldn't add too much time, and then kind of working the patient through it. But again, if you look at who that's probably going to happen on, like you said, older patients, osteopenic patients, deep impactions related to sort of pericoronal cysts, et cetera, just being smarter in who you take teeth out. I've certainly gotten more conservative as I've moved along in practice. You know, those cases that I was really gung-ho to go after as a resident, I sort of, it's not uncommon for me to just sort of milk people along and let's keep an eye on this bad boy. And, you know, look, at some point it'll probably be time to take it out. But my elective jumping in on a 70-year-old wisdom tooth, that's slowed way down these days, unless they've got massive probing defects, mobility, a lot of active suppuration. I just sort of like, yeah, I mean, it's been impacted right there for, yeah, you get a lot of old people like, I think this is causing crowding in my teeth. And you're like, I don't think that's causing any crowding, my friend. That bad boy's been sitting dormant for the last 47 years. So let's just keep an eye on it. Well, my dentist really wants me to get it out. I'm like, well, your dentist should probably take it out then, because it's not bothering me like it's bothering them. So anyway, that would be my two cents on those types of fractures. I don't think you would, as a LMS, like, you're not going to see a parasymphysis or body fracture from a tooth extraction. It's always going to be an angle. And, you know, look at the x-ray. If it's a thin inferior border, if it looks like there's not much, I mean, you could consider doing it in the OR if it really needed to come out, and putting a plate on in the operating room preemptively, you know what I mean? Just to prevent it. But, you know, most of the time you get away with taking it out and putting people on a liquid diet and calling that a day. I have seen one recently. I had a guy that he had a third taken out, lower left, and pathologic fracture. And he just was sort of malmanaged, I guess, inappropriately managed right out the gate. I mean, they kind of didn't really do much for a little while. And then they wired him down, and then they went back in and put a Champy plate on. And then he sort of, I don't know if he started getting a little frustrated with them and didn't really follow up. And then he came to see me, and he had a pretty rip-roaring osteomyelitis. And this guy is like kind of a high-functioning sort of TV profile guy, and I had to take him to the OR and do a segmental resection and put a big recon bar in through his neck and take some hip bone and you know, obviously trying to talk him off of the litigation bridge, because I just don't feel like in most cases litigation's healthy. But you know, people get frustrated when they don't feel like they're A, cared about, or B, treated in an appropriate fashion. And so I guess at the end of the day, if you don't do a lot of mandible fractures and you have that crack, and there's groups in your area that do a lot of those, get them turfed off and get them dealt with appropriately early. You know, if the last mandible you did was 7 years ago, maybe you shouldn't be dealing with it anyway. You know what I mean? It's no shame in sending it to somebody that deals with it more frequently and offering to lend a hand. You know, hey man, I don't really do these, but I'd love to come jump into the OR with you and hold sticks and let's bang this out. And, you know what I mean? Just get them dealt with quickly and appropriately and do it the right way, as opposed to sort of limping things along and doing stuff that you're really not that comfortable with.
I really like what you're saying. I think like this case you're talking about, a lot of the problem happens when people aren't diagnosing it immediately, right? And I'm not sure if that's because they don't really know or have any clue that it just happened, or like you're saying, they're too afraid to kind of do the imaging and really look into it and treat it. But because it would be so much better to treat it right when it happens, not a month later.
Right. It's fresh. Bone margins are clean. There's no swelling. It's so much better to do it at the time as opposed to letting people function. And, you know, you really, if you have this inclination and you take a film and it's like, I don't know, I don't really see anything. We have a CT scanner. Most places these days do shoot a CT scan. And, you know, the problem is people like, they kind of think something might've happened, and then they have them like bite down and their occlusion hasn't changed. Of course their occlusion's not going to change, you know, but they look and the bite looks pretty stable. And how do you feel? And you're palpating externally. And if you don't see anything and the bite's still on, due diligence would say, bring them back in a week, put them on a liquid diet, re-image in a week. A lot of times at that point, you'll start to see these things a little bit more manifest and you'll start to see these subtle changes in occlusion. I think the few cases that I've been involved with peripherally where I've treated these from other practitioners, it was sort of like, I thought there might be a fracture the day of, but their bite was pretty good. And then I told them to see me if they had any issues. And then, and the patient doesn't know what's normal and not normal. And, you know, all of a sudden they show back up at the oral surgeon's office or the dentist's office, you know, 3 or 4 weeks post-op, and their bite's a little off. And then they've got this new or persistent swelling, and the patient's kind of like, well, I thought it was normal to have swelling because I just had a wisdom tooth out, and then it's been a month, and I was talking to my friend and their swelling was gone in like, you know, 7 days, and I'm still puffy. And then you take an x-ray and proximal segments rotated up, and they've got a bunch of funky osteoid in the area and a fibrous union, and it just is so much easier to deal with it immediately. So my advice there is just take images, diagnose early, and treat it. And if you don't feel comfortable treating it, then call your buddy that does and treat it with them, you know.
To add on to your comment about having a plating kit, I have one with me. I think they only cost about $5,000 or something like that. And that was from KLS Martin, which is the most expensive place. But I think totally, totally worth it to have one in the office.
I think so. And, you know, like most of the time, we use so many plates and screws that your rep will take good care of you. I mean, you know, if you just said, hey, I don't even need the kit, I want, 4 or 5 6-millimeter screws, 4 or 5 8-millimeter screws, and give me a couple of 4-hole, you know, tension bands. And you can just kind of have them autoclaved and there you can bend them with wire twisters or even hemostats if you needed to, and you have access to what you need. And then, you know, have a screw, a drill bit, 6 or 8-millimeter drill bit is all you're going to use in that side. And those usually, we use a BNR units in our office. They should index right into your unit and off you go, you know. But most people have that for ramus grafts and that kind of stuff. We use those little plate screw sets all the time for ramus grafts. So just add a plate or two and you're golden.
I've seen a couple, not many, but a couple, you know, that were 20-year-old healthy people from colleagues or different people after the fact. But I think in those cases where they actually managed to have a fracture with a 20-year-old person and a horizontal wisdom tooth, is probably like you're saying, too much force, not enough usage of the drill and sectioning and removing bone, you know, that type of thing. I think maybe in residency, they kind of give you crap, I guess, some programs about not using your drill a lot. And man, you're really, you know, pulling that drill out with every tooth. But I've become more apt to section those teeth and really take it out piece by piece, as opposed to get my elevator in there as quick as I can and start cranking on that mother, you know?
I'm right there with you. I feel like there's a sense, you know, when you're using a lot of force. And for me, it's sort of like if I section the distal aspect and I start to elevate, and it's just sort of, I can feel like I'm putting a lot on, it's easy. I just take a little more crown off. Or, you know, it's not uncommon for me to vertically section a tooth. And you know, sometimes you'll get like the distal half of the crown comes off, but it doesn't come with the distal root. And then as you go to elevate, the mesial part of the crown, which contains both roots, kind of gets hung up. And it's like, well, then I just take a burr and I horizontally section the crown and pop the crown off and then bring out the roots. I mean, it takes like 2 minutes, and you don't have to use any force, as opposed to like, you can definitely, I use a 46R elevator. You can definitely sneak that under the crown and pry, and it'll come out, but it also comes out with a big chunk of interradicular bone. And it just, for me, it makes no sense. It's just finesse it out. Take an extra minute or two and drill a little bit more, and it keeps you out of trouble.
Exactly. Totally agree. Going back to the patient who's the trauma patient who has multiple fractures, what is your algorithm or protocol for sequencing? I'm figuring out, okay, let's do this fracture first and then that one. And how do you go about that?
Those depend on what you have. So I trained with Ed Ellis, and he's probably the most prolific author on mandible fractures. And he was really passionate about doing things in a reproducible fashion. And so for us, let's say that I have a parasymphysis and an angle fracture. Historically, I would make sure that the more anterior fracture was treated first and then moving posterior. So if you have a parasymphysis angle condyle, I'm going to treat the parasymphysis or body fracture first. And then I'm going to treat the angle or ramus fracture, and then I'm going to treat the condyle fracture. So I'll go from kind of tooth bearing to non-tooth bearing, anterior to posterior. And the reason is the more proximal fractures are easier to get anatomic alignment with if you've set the bite, right? So, and it's easy to set the bite if you have teeth. A little bit different if you're an edentulous person. And in those cases, I'm using stout plates and screws. But in a tooth bearing patient that has reproducibility of bite, it's always easier to plate the tooth bearing segment first, because you can sock in the occlusion and use the occlusion to help you to anatomically reduce the fractures. The sort of protocol up until 2020 was rigid internal fixation for more anterior fractures, and then functional stability at one. So we would always say, look, you have to rigidly plate every fracture but one. You can leave one fracture functionally stable or not reduced. So like, let's say that you had a parasymphysis fracture, an angle fracture, and a condyle fracture. Well, you could, with the three fractures, there's enough intersegmental mobility that we would say we need rigid internal fixation on two of the fractures, and then one of them you can kind of let swing. So you might say, and that one usually is the condyle, right? If you're going to let anything go, it's probably going to be a condyle. Obviously, you could not treat an angle fracture or a body or a parasymphysis fracture. So we would go rigid fixation. And to me, rigid fixation is no intersegmental mobility, which means you need to be using a 1.25 millimeter, that's not screw diameter, that's plate thickness plate at the inferior border. And that's going to prevent mobility between the fracture segments. There was a study that was done, a multi-center international study in 2020, where they looked at bilateral fractures. And it was actually a really, really well-designed study with Danny Perez and Ed Ellis and others. And they plated, they basically split the two, I think 300 and some odd patients into two groups. And one of the groups was treated with that algorithm, rigid internal fixation on the body or tooth bearing fracture and functional stability. And when I say functional stability, that's a Shompi style plating technique. So the Shompi technique is not rigid internal fixation. It's non-rigid internal fixation or functional stability. So they would put rigid fixation on the body and functional stability or non-rigid at the angle. And then the other group was non-rigid fixation at both fractures, meaning small plates, a single plate at the body and a single plate at the angle. And oddly enough, both groups did pretty well. So that might argue to say that maybe you can get away without using big plates up front. And so rigid fixation for me is like you could take two smaller plates or one big plate, tension band and inferior border band. Now, the one thing they did do is they had arch bars on in every one of those cases, and maybe having the arch bars acts as a tension band on the non-rigid fixation of the body or symphysis. So I'm not sure, like in my practice, I really don't place arch bars. I pretty much fix everything with IMF screws, and then screws in, screws out. You know what I mean? They go out and they don't have any hardware in. But anyway, if I were going to sequence, for me still today, I'm still going to go rigid internal fixation, body or symphysis, and then move to the angle. If there's a concomitant condyle fracture, I'm probably going to rigidly fixate the angle, and I'm going to look at the condyle and decide what I want to do with that based on where the fracture is. I open a lot of condyle fractures, and I think some of that may be just my comfort level with TMJ surgery. I also do a lot of elective TMJ surgery, mostly joint replacements these days. But I'm pretty comfortable if I need to do a preauricular or endoral incision and jump into the you know, pericapsular space. That's not too big of a deal for me. My approach of choice for a condyle is usually just a retromandibular transparotid approach, and I've found over the years, I think a lot of condyles rehab pretty nicely. If it's a unilateral condyle fracture, they can rehab pretty well with just arch bars. But I've just kind of noticed over the last probably 10 years, the lower the fracture is on the condylar neck, I mean, the harder it is to functionally rehab patients. So for me, pretty much anything that's extra capsular, so mid neck all the way down, anything, of course, sigmoid or below for positive, I'm going to plate it. And sigmoid up to the capsule, I'm probably going to plate it. And then when you start getting into diacapitular fractures or these intracapsular fractures, most of the time, if they haven't lost any vertical height, I leave them alone. But I've just found that when you try to functionally rehabilitate a low condylar neck fracture or subcondylar fracture, it's just a struggle. You have to be really, really patient. I think there's a tendency for people to try to fix fractures these days with these hybrid fixation systems. So like the Matrix Wave system that's made by Synthes, KLS has a similar one. It's like a screw-in arch bar kind of deal, but it's not tooth-bearing. It's using screws up in the alveolus. You know, really, it's hard to manage bites with that because you don't have the ability to mold the occlusion. Arch bars are nice because they're on the teeth, and you can, because of that, get some orthodontic movement of teeth and or alveolus with arch bars on. It's my advice to people, if they're trying to treat condyles closed, I would put arch bars on. I wouldn't try to do it with one of these hybrid systems because these screws are in the bone as opposed to wires around teeth. You really can't mold bone with wires that are sitting up above teeth roots. And secondly, those things need to stay in for anywhere from 4 to 8 weeks, you know, and you need to be seeing the patient back regularly and changing elastic patterns. And it's hard to run elastics off of IMF screws. They loosen. And it's also when you have those big hybrid fixation systems, the gingiva grows over them and into them, and it's just a disaster. And they're big and thick and gross, and they're all bloody. So for me, if I'm going to try to functionally rehab a intracapsular or diacapitular fracture, one of these crush injuries or one of these shear injuries where you shear off maybe 2 or 3 millimeters of the head of the condyle in an oblique fashion, I'm going to put arch bars on those patients, and we're going to run elastics, and the elastics are going to be used to sort of balance out or fight against muscular tendencies. Typically, it's a class 2 elastic on the side of the condyle fracture and some balancing elastics on the other side with varying levels of heaviness in terms of the elastics that you use. But again, I'm just one where if it's a low enough fracture, I'm going to plate it. And sometimes that means an endoral incision. I've done some lately where they were high enough that I didn't even need a retromandibular incision. We just plated it right through the endoral incision, and you can get your holes. I like to use something a little more stout, like posteriorly along the neck. And then I put just an anti-rotational 3-hole plate anteriorly. So you have, you know, 4 screws on each side of the fracture. Well, 3 screws on each side of the fracture, And that seems to be good with rotation and whatnot. I figured, you know, Danny Perez down in San Antonio, he's doing total joint replacements through a single and/or incision, which is just mind blowing to me. But they're getting everything in without a retro or a submandibular. And so I figure if he can get a total joint in through one incision, I can certainly plate a fractured condyle through one incision. So sometimes if they're high, I just make one end oral incision, and sometimes you need a trocar and sometimes you don't, but we can get those bad boys uprighted and plated. And, you know, I think the old adage was, you know, there was an absolute indication for condyle fractures. And those were things like, you know, fracture dislocated out of the fossa, or condyle in the middle cranial fossa, or I don't look at that so much these days as I look at the idea of how predictable is my ability to get this guy back into a functional occlusion going to be with open versus closed. And if the answer is, look, he sheared off 2 millimeters of the head of the condyle, or the condylar head was crushed, you know, they hit their chin hard and they crushed one condylar head or both condylar head. You know, those little crush injuries, they rehab great with elastics. On the flip side, if I have a low condylar neck fracture that's at the level of the sigmoid, I mean, it doesn't matter to me if the condyle is dislocated or subluxated out of the fossa. For the most part, if it's complete and if it's displaced, I'm going to fix it. If it's not displaced, those are cases where I might, like I just had last week, a 79-year-old lady, and she had a low condylar neck fracture, but it really wasn't. I mean, it was buckled a little bit, maybe 10 degrees of bowing, but her occlusion was spot on. And so that's one where she's not even going to get arch bars. She's going to get, hey man, stay on a liquid diet. I'll see you in 7 days, and I'll see you every 7 days for the first 6 weeks. And assuming the bite stays stable, no reason to do much. So same thing goes for kids. You know, a lot of these pediatric fractures, the bite's still pretty on. A lot of times they're in mixed dentition, and unless it's really, you know, a pretty low fracture that's displaced, I don't really worry about doing much with those guys. It's just a lot of follow-up. You have to be willing to see your patients regularly and intervene early. That's where, like, if you have somebody that you've decided, I'm going to treat non-op, but I'm not going to see you for 3 weeks, when they come in, you're going to have a problem. You know what I mean? Versus, hey, I've had patients where I'm swapping out elastics every 4 to 5 days, just so I'm keeping an eye on things in that early period where, you know, because up to about 3 weeks, you can still kind of mobilize bone segments pretty easily. Actually, we did a ZMC last week that was 8 weeks old, and it took a couple of little osteotomes, but the cheekbone mobilized no problem. So, you know, you can, if you're following up with people regularly, you have time to intervene if things start heading south for that first 3 weeks. You know what I mean? So that's been my algorithm anyway. That was a long rambling answer, but that's the way that I've chosen to approach things in my practice now. IMF screws, set the more distal bite first, usually with a little bit more stout plates. I'll use like a two millimeter thick or a 1.25 millimeter thick plate at the inferior border for body and parasymphysis fracture. And then I, for the most part, just use the Champy technique on angles. If you had, like, let's say you had a midline symphysis and bilateral angles, I would rigidly treat the symphysis and rigidly treat one of the angles. And then I would non-rigidly treat the last angle. So I still kind of adhere to that, where you need to have rigid fixation low at least all the fractures but one. There were some studies that were done years ago where they looked at intergonial angle width with mouth opening, and the intergonial angle width actually decreases with wide mouth opening. I can't remember at this point what the number is, but there's some, you know, there's compression at the inferior border at the angles when you open, and there's a lot of weird rotational torque forces. And my feeling is, if you have two angles, you probably need to have rigid plates on one of those guys. Otherwise, you just have too much intersegmental mobility. And that's assuming I let people function early. I mean, if I use rigid fixation at the body or symphysis and a Champy at the angle, I don't leave them wired shut for like a minute. I just kind of tell them, hey, you're on a liquid diet, so we didn't treat you wired, but you need to act like you're wired in terms of diet and function. And it's interesting. You'll see some, when you use a Champy style superior border tension band at an angle, it'll line up beautifully in the OR, right? You're looking at the superior border all the way down to the inferior border. And then you see them like a week later and their occlusion is still spot on, but you take a 3D CT scan And the caudal aspect of the proximal segment's doing all sorts of crazy stuff sometimes. You know, it's got a big diastasis, or there's a big gap at the inferior border, and you're looking and you're like, oh my gosh, this is going south. But their bite's still spot on. And then you just keep rolling. You're like, all right, man, I'll see you next week. Keep the diet liquid. And as long as patients are compliant, you know, it's bizarre, but that segment settles in and their bite never changes and they live happily ever after. It's like a magic technique, but don't be dissuaded by the fact that you take a CT and you're like, holy mackerel, man, this has gone to hell in a handbasket. And they've got a freaking non-union, fibrous union, malunion. Now it's just like, something magic happens in the pterygomasseteric sheath and they heal. But it can be disconcerting with x-rays.
And when you say that you, like, if you were going to treat one of the angles with rigid fixation, are you talking about like an inferior border plate or two mini plates there? Or what are you doing?
You could do either. So for me, I will hold the segments together with a Champy style plate. And then I drop a little bit more stout inferior border plate. You could do a non-contoured superior border plate. So I had an attending in San Antonio, actually Tom Jeter, shout out to Tom Jeter, St. Angelo, Texas, who with Joe Van Sickles invented rigid internal fixation, according to them. And they were using Radio Shack mini screwdrivers that they'd put wads of acrylic on the handle and, you know, twist them in using finger plates from the orthopedic guys down in San Antonio, Texas. But anyway, Jeter was convinced that you didn't need to, like, you know, the Champy style, you're sort of contouring so that some of the screws are sitting on the superior aspect of the proximal segment or even potentially on the medial aspect of the proximal segment. And then it kind of contours and wraps down to where the more distal screws are on the lateral aspect of the distal segment. Anyway, he sort of feels like, well, now you can just stick a plate on the superior lateral border of the kind of the angle and it does the same thing. And I've tried that and it does tend to work, but I'd put a plate up high and I'd put a plate down low, just kind of something at the angle. Remember the problem with rigid internal fixation at the level of the angle. And I tell this when I've worked with residents in the past, if you plate them and they have a malocclusion at the time of plating, they are going to have a malocclusion when you see them in a week and at 2 weeks and a month, like rigid fixation, the bite's not going to settle in. The Champy style, it will. Like you can plate them and with let's say the body's spot on, and you use a superior border tension band at the angle, and you know, you take them out and you're like, oh, I've got a tiny little bit of an open bite on the side of the angle. That will usually settle in. You know, with function, a lot of times you don't even need elastics; they just sort of function right in because again, that's not a rigid fixation, just kind of holding the two bone fragments together. Whereas if you plate the angle with rigid fixation and you take them out of IMF and they have an open bite, they're going to have an open bite in a week when you see them, and then at 2 weeks and at 2 months, like, and eventually, you know, I guess they may get super eruption of the teeth on that side, but your ability to tolerate a subtle malocclusion with rigid fixation should be zero. Like your tolerance for that anyway, you have to make it perfect. So anyway, if I decide I'm going to rigidly fixate an angle, I still put a superior border, just kind of a Champy style bend up high, and then I drop. Once the two fragments are stabilized, then I'll drop an inferior border plate on. And most of the time, you know, in the plating sets, it's pretty rare that you have to use the angle, you know, the plate with the prefabricated angle bent into it. Most of the time, those angle fractures don't go right through the gonial angle. They sort of fracture through the third molar site or through the retromolar region. And the break frequently is a centimeter and a half anterior to the angle. So you can use a straight plate a lot of times without having to, you know, get that big pre-contoured angle plate out. Because those screws, as they wind up or as you wander up the posterior aspect of the ramus, it's hard to get those without a trocar. So you start all of a sudden having to use a percutaneous approach to get in. And, you know, I use trocars with like impunity. I don't, whatever, man. If I have a hard time getting at something, I'd rather trocar come through and get it directly. Than I've seen some screws where I've taken them out for other folks. And it's like they put the screw in at like a 94 degree angle. You're like, dude, how did you ever think this was going to work? Like, I don't even know how the screw is in the plate. It's coming in at such a crazy angle. I mean, remember, you've got about 15 degrees of play. in those plate and screw fixation systems. And like, if you're coming in at 45 degrees off kilter, like it just, first of all, the screw head half the time strips and then like you can't get it out and it's like the worst ever. So second level of advice for anybody doing mandibles is don't over tighten the screws, because it's on occasion you have to go take them out and then they're freaking stripped. I mean, if I had a dollar for every screw head that I went in, like from an outside provider where there's a malocclusion that we're trying to take plates off and reosteotomize or whatever, and the screw heads are totally stripped out, and then you end up having to cut the plate off and be trefine out the drill. It's like the worst ever. So anyway, yeah, don't over tighten. I use locking stuff, by the way, personally, for if I'm using rigid fixation on like a more stout plate, I always use locking screws. The nice thing about locking screws is it's like having an internal external fixator. Your adaptation of the plate doesn't have to be perfect. You're using the plate just like in X-Fix, basically. So whereas if you use non-locking screws, it's going to drag segments to your plate and it's going to create some issues. At the Shompi, Superior Border, I use non-locking screws with those. But lockers on big guys that you're trying to hold bones in place. And then on condyles, one last point on those, like you can underdo it in terms of fixation. The tendency is, you're working in like a little hole and you're like, you know, stressed out about regional anatomy and you're stressed out about bagging branches of the facial nerve. And so you're conservative with the dissection and then you can't really see that well. And so you're putting small plates in and then those small plates bend. There's nothing worse than like a bent condyle plate that you've got to go secondarily retrieve. I use a nice stout plate at the posterior border and make your access big enough to see, you know, if you look at the studies on the transparotid retromandibular approach, I've done that approach with some ENT friends here in town. Like, it's funny, the ENT guys that I work with, like, are doing facectomies, you know, they're like just taking everything off and they're like these just wicked surgeons. And then they're all nervous about doing an end oral approach. Like, oh, I don't know about that, man. I'm going to need you to come in. You're like, dude, you just did like a 5-level neck dissection. What are you talking about? Like, they're like nervous to make our transparotid and it, because it goes in the face of everything that they're trained. Like, I kind of joke sometimes that the oral surgeons, you know, modus operandi is like, well, just don't see the nerves and you're in good shape. Like, I don't know. I never saw it. So I think we're going to be good. Like the ENTs, like, meticulously dissect out and find every individual branch, protect it, push it out of the way. And we're like, well, I did the submandibular and I never saw the nerve. So they should be good. Or, you know, when I blasted through the parotid gland with reckless abandon and like, yeah, I never saw anything and the face didn't twitch. So we should be perfect. And so when I've done those with the ENTs, you know, it's like, literally, it's like a nice meticulous dissection through the skin, subcutaneous soft tissues. You get through the remnants of the platysma. Then you get onto the parotid capsule. That's meticulously dissected through. And then I just manhandle my way through the parotid gland to the lateral ramus. And it's like, you know, the ENTs are just like, oh my gosh, what's going on? And, you know, you're like, don't worry about it, man. If as long as the face isn't twitching and we don't see anything, we're going to be in good shape. But, you know, you get through the parotid, remember to spread in the direction of the nerve fibers, because so kind of like in a more anterior to posterior vector. And I usually, like, once I get through the parotid capsule, I just take a really thin tonsil hemostat and just bluntly dissect straight down to wood and then spread and then take a sen retractor, a ragnell. You can take a small toe end retractor, get one anteriorly, one posteriorly, and then take another a tonsil hemostat and spread vertically and you're right on the masseter muscle. And then I just open up the masseter with the Bovi and off you go. It's like literally, it's about a 3.5 minute approach. And as long as you close the parotid capsule nice and tight, I use running locking closure on the capsule so they don't get a parotidocutaneous fistula. You're golden. Now I have another guy that I've worked with over the years that showed me this kind of modified Risdon approach where that's what I've used. I used to use a classic submandibular incision for total joint replacement. Now I use this kind of modified Risdon kind of deal. Basically, you just cut down at about 1.5 centimeters inferior to the angle right onto the sternocleidomastoid muscle, and you just lift the parotid tail right off the SCM, and there's a really nice bloodless plane you can dissect through there. It's fast and it's super efficient, and then you don't have to do your standard, you know, submandibular approach where you're at the antagonial region, you're having to find the facial artery and vein and reflect those. I do use that approach on occasion, but this kind of modified angle approach is super fast. For us, it's just like when you start seeing parotid tail, you get a little bit nervous, but having operated around some of these head and neck guys, it's really quick. The only relevant anatomy in the region is sometimes you'll see the greater auricular nerve, so you have to be careful you don't cut that or you leave the patient with a numb ear. But that's a super fast. So if you have kind of a low angle you're going at, or a low condyle that sort of is more of a ramus fracture, or an angle, and you decide you want to go transcutaneous, I use that sort of lift the tail off the SCM and dissect in that bloodless field. But for a standard subcondylar, the transparotid, if you look at the numbers, that the incidence of facial nerve issues with that are just incredibly low. And it's something that, like, if you haven't done it before, you just need to spend a little time doing it. Like I said, literally last week, I opened five condyles and plated five condyles and didn't have any nerve issues with any of those. It's just a matter of being comfortable and kind of knowing what you're doing and using blunt dissection techniques. Again, it goes in the face of what I would call sound surgery by not identifying relevant anatomy. You're just like, all right, there's the parotid, dive through, you know, and it makes you take a step back the first few times you do it. But when you're comfortable with it, it's super fast and it's super straightforward.
Those are really helpful tips. I appreciate you sharing that. I was also going to ask you, you know, about how you treat, like, that first case you were talking about where you do have the delayed treatment of a fracture and now you have osteomyelitis. How are you dealing with a case like that?
I'm a huge believer in infectious disease consults. I mean, there's this sense, and, you know, I just feel like, look, once the infection's in the bone, they need a PICC line. And typically we're using Invans or Ertapenem. If you have a deep-seated bone infection, it needs to be treated the way any other deep-seated bone infection is treated. You would never see an orthopedic guy get osteo and, you know, not turf it out to ID and let ID deal with the infection part and you deal with the surgical part. And there's this sense of, like, you know, one of the things that we as oral surgeons struggle with is, like, it's this idea that we can't do everything. It's like, you know, we fought I listened to Bob Marks on your podcast recently and talking about the way that our profession has changed, right? Where we were fighting years ago for H&P privileges even. And we were fighting for the ability to take call. And there's this sense now that we can do everything and we don't need anybody's help. And so, like, because of that, yeah, I'm totally going to sedate this 18-month-old in my clinic because I can do that because that's how awesome I am. And I'm going to treat this osteomyelitis. I'm going to start the PICC line on my own and I'm going to be analyzing, you know, glomerular filtration rate. And I'm going to be looking at renal lab values because, damn it, I'm an oral surgeon and we basically are nephrologists. It's like, she's just like, no, you're not. Just why don't you consult the ID guys and let them do it? So, you know, I just consult ID and I say, man, I got a guy that's got an osteo and I'm going to do the surgeon's part and you do the infectious disease part. It's a novel concept. But, you know, I mean, I wouldn't put it past some of my buddies to, like, freaking start the PICC line. They're like, no, I got an ultrasound in my office and I do the PICC and a chest x-ray, you know. It's like just so anyway, in those cases, like Mark said in his podcast with you, I do a lot of stuff in the hospital. I mean, ultimately, there are limitations to what you can safely do in the office. And when I say safely, you need big access if you're going to be debriding bone that's got osteomyelitis. So from the standpoint of comfort, like, I just feel like in my hands, sometimes I tolerate less than ideal if I'm in the office. You're like, I think that was pretty good. Like, patient starts getting a little squirrely. You're down by the nerve. You're fiddling with the nerve. They're starting to flinch a little bit. Where in the operating room, you're probably going to have loops on and you're going to take a little extra time. For example, stripping a cyst off of a nerve that's kind of grown down. You know, are we leaving stuff because we're sedating people and it's starting to bother them and we're like, I think that was good enough. Like, in the hospital, you don't have to worry about that. They're generally anesthetized and just get it right. And so for me, if I've got somebody that has an old fracture and they've got an osteomyelitis, we're going to go to the OR. I'm going to admit the patient. I'm going to consult ID during the admission, let them know, hey man, this guy had a third molar out or whatever happened. He's got an ankle fracture. He's now got a non-union and an osteomyelitis to boot. Take him to the OR and I just do an aggressive debridement to bleeding bone. And if the debridement to bleeding bone means they've got a segmental defect or continuity defect, then that's what's going to be left. And I'm going to plate it. Now, the nice thing with a lot of these cases these days is you can be pretty strategic. Like, so in the last case that I had with this, with like that I got referred over, you know, I just use like Materialize. You know, I don't get paid by Materialize. So, but those are the guys that I use. I send in a 3D scan of them. We set the bite, we set the segments, and then they prefab a custom plate for me. So there's no bending in situ. So look, if they've been rolling for 6 weeks and they've got an osteo at this point, like, and you're looking at the CT scan, and you're like, yeah, I'm going to have to resect bone. Like, to me, these days, it makes zero sense to go to the OR without a plate already built. Like, why would I want to go bend a plate? I'm just going to say, okay, well, look, we'll get the PICC line rolling now. We'll go in and sometimes I'll take a little biopsy in the office and I'll send it off for culture and gram stain. And, you know, then we have the diagnosis of osteo and we can species identify what bugs are brewing down there. In the meantime, I've submitted a 3D scan and we have an intraoral scanner in the office. So I'll send that data in. We'll set the occlusion, set the proximal and distal segments, and I have a super custom plate built. And so I'm going to zip back in and drop the plate. You don't have to go through the neck in some cases. Sometimes we'll just do debridement resection and you can get the plates on right through the mouth. And other times, you know, they need a little incision. You go through the neck, but you're pre-drilling screw holes and then you know your plate's spot on as opposed to, you know, the archaic technique of bending big recon bars. You know, I just, for me, anytime I can use super custom stuff these days, I do. And that even goes with orbital floors. I mean, you know, they can flip a super custom orbital floor plate in like 9 days. So you're like, well, 9 days, if you send in the scan at the time it comes in, by the time the swelling's gone, you've got a plate that's already built for you, you know? So that's what I would do in the context of osteo. I'm going to get a PICC line. I'm going to let ID manage the antibiotic, antimicrobial therapy based on species. I'm going to let ID manage their renal and liver labs. And then I'm going to be a surgeon and do what I do best, you know, and that is just cut dead bone out.
Exactly. Well, that's super helpful because I think there's a lot of these cases that aren't your cut and dry textbook thing. And, you know, sometimes you're stumbling through the sequence and how should I treat all this stuff? It's good to hear what you do.
You know, for practice like mine, I have a buddy down in El Paso, Texas. Shout out to Vernon Burke down there. He and I did dental school together. We did residency together. I mean, he's like, we talk 3 or 4 days a week. And it's funny how he has a massive, gosh, down in El Paso. I mean, they've gone from, in fact, he'd be a good person to have on here probably. He kind of showed up down there and 10 years later, they have a head neck cancer program and a craniofacial fellowship, and they've got a cleft craniofacial clinic in Juarez, Mexico, and they've got residents rotating through. I mean, it's just like this really amazing thing that they've sort of done down there. But we talk all the time on the way into the office, and it's like, for us, we're in the OR all the time, and it's no skin off our back to just throw stuff on, you know? Like I had last week, I had a kid with pretty bad epilepsy and severe autism. Like, I think a lot of people would probably sedate that kid. I had to take out 4 bicuspids on him. And he was just, you know, during the consult, I got the sense that it was going to be a rodeo in the office. So, you know, for me, it's like, whatever, dude, I'll just stick him on at the beginning or the end of an OR day and let the anesthesia folks breathe him down and I'll whip him out real quick, you know? And then they can deal with him when he's having emergence delirium problems. It's so nice to walk out of the room and let the anesthesiologist deal with the screaming child as opposed to having the screaming child in your office. So, you know, for us, it's so easy to just slap these cases on at the beginning or the end of the day because it's not like you're going out of your way to do it. But there's this tendency that we have, again, as oral surgeons to like try to deal with all this stuff in our office. And at the end of the day, it's like, dude, Our founding fathers fought for hospital privileges. Go to the hospital and use the hospital for what the hospital is there for. And if you haven't been there, it's okay, man. They'll walk you through how to write orders and admit people and do all the stuff that you know, we spent 4 and 6 years like learning how to navigate the hospital. And then people leave and it's like, I don't have hospital privileges anymore. And you're like, are you freaking kidding me? Like, how do you do this? Like, I don't know. So that's my probably parting advice with everybody is use the hospital. It's an invaluable tool. You don't have to, I get a lot of referrals from other oral surgeons that say, well, I'm not in, you know, I did this thing or that thing and the patient's got osteo now, or they've got this or they've got that. And I'm not in network with their medical insurance. And so I'm going to send them over to see you because you are. And you're like, yeah, well, you don't have to bill them. Like, you don't have to bill them, you know, $7,000 for open treatment of a continuity. Like, do the right thing. If you cause the problem, take them to the OR and fix it. Don't send them to me because you're not in network. You know, there was a Matt Gordon, who was one of my attendings in San Antonio. I feel like practices oral surgery the right way. Something rolls into his office, they're going to get treated. And if they don't have money, they're going to get treated. I heard him on one occasion sort of like ask a patient, like, you know, what do you think you could afford? And the patient was like, yeah, I don't know, a couple $100. All right, dude, we'll do it for a couple $100. I mean, at the end of the day, we have a skill set and we make plenty of money taking out teeth and putting in dental implants. Look, man, you don't have to go to Columbia to do, you know, community service work and to do cool things. You can do cool things for people right here in your own state. You can do it for free and you can make somebody's day. And I've tried to follow that mantra to some degree. Like, I've sort of made it my goal to never turn anybody away for finances. So if I get somebody that rolls in or somebody comes in on call or they have this, that, or the other, you know, man, I'm going to put them on at 5 p.m. And I wasn't going to be doing anything that day anyway at 5 p.m. So whether I make a dollar or whether I don't make anything, you leave and you feel like you've done something good for somebody. And, you know, obviously you can't do everything for free, but there are times when the ox is in the mire and patients are really in a bad spot and you have a skill set and you can treat them. And you know, whether they have insurance or they don't, just do the right thing, man. Freaking fix the jaw, fix the osteo, fix the whatever. And karma will pay itself forward over time, I feel like. So
totally agree. Those are awesome comments. I really appreciate you taking the time to share all these techniques, your stories. Really invaluable. Are you okay if listeners contact you if they have further follow-up questions?
Sure, anytime. My email is probably the best. Just Aaron Liddell, AaronLiddell at Gmail. Feel free. And I can give you my 100% anecdotal, non-evidence-based approach to the practice of oral surgery. Yeah, anytime people have any questions, I'm more than happy to give you my biased opinion.
Well, I really appreciate that. Thank you so much for taking this time, and let's reconnect.
Anytime, man. Love being on with you, and love shooting the breeze. Always fun.
Thanks, Aaron. Have a good rest of the day.
All right, man.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Everyday Oral Surgery. If you are an oral and maxillofacial surgeon and would like to be on this podcast, please email me at grantstuckey@gmail.com or text me at 720-441-6059. Also, if you have any topics that you would like to hear discussed or feedback on a certain episode that has already aired, please call or email or text me. Thanks again for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode.